Hello everyone, welcome back to Right to the Source. We are on episode 20. My name is Robin Harrison. I'm here as ever with the butthead to my Beavis, Mr. Ed Birkin. Ed, how the devil are you today?
I'm well, thank you. I don't know if I've ever actually seen Beavis and Butthead.
It's very good.
Bill and Ted, I've seen that.
You've seen Bill and Ted?
There we go. I've seen Bill and Ted, yeah.
That's good. You've seen...
I'm sure there's a line I can remember from, like, someone used to quote it when I was at primary school. So can I drag this up from over 30 years ago? No, carry on.
No, you can't. Okay. Well, you'll just have to wait to find out what Ed was thinking midway through the episode. I wouldn't bet against him suddenly kind of shouting out what he actually thought.
It was something like, what's that? Oh, it's a present. But you're not my girlfriend. It doesn't mean I can't buy you a present. It does. What is it? It's a gun rack. A gun rack? A gun rack? I don't even own a gun, let alone many guns to necessitate an entire rack. What would I use with a gun rack? I think it was something like that.
Okay.
I mean, the start of this episode's gone terribly. Let's improve it with some... Well, let's give a roundup of the sports of the week.
Oh, yeah, let's find out.
I've got a question for you.
Okay.
So, Sheffield Wednesday won, 3 points on the board.
Excellent.
Sheffield United lost again.
No. Oh, no.
0 points because of the mighty Charlton. Shout out to our Steve Sidwell lookalike fan, Charlton fan, who's very happy about it. Who is actually one of the only people I know who listens every single week. Although I think he just fast forwards to search for quote himself.
When you bring him up.
Anyway, so Sheffield Wednesday 1-0 up against a terrible Portsmouth team. I say that their manager said, like, it's the worst we've ever played. Anyway, then a through ball came in the second half. Through ball goes through, played down the pitch. And the defender was massive favourite to get there and pulled up with a did his hamstring and pulled up so he couldn't run. So then the striker pretty much had a free ball, you know, through and went on and scored. And I just felt a bit not quite right. Now, I know you only stop games with head injuries and stuff. And don't get me wrong, I'm glad Wednesday got the first 3 points. And I wouldn't blame anyone for carrying on. But it's my team, I don't know, I just felt as though it was on the cusp of unsportsmanlike. But then, you know, where do you draw the line kind of thing? If anyone just... Because also you have players who just fake it. Yeah? Quite frankly, you cannot trust footballers. This guy didn't. but at what point do you kind of go, well, he wasn't going to win the race, so he pretends that he's hurt a bit, or if he's just fallen out, you know. So I get why they carried on, but it just still felt a little...
Yeah, no, I can get that. I mean, I always remember when De Canio, I think it was against Everton, like the keeper went down injured and he just kicked the ball out of play.
Yeah, but back in the day, people didn't fake injuries as much.
No, that's true.
People complain about the rule that if you get injured, if you get the physio on, you then have to go off for a few seconds, and it, you know, disadvantages, you know, the team who's someone's got an injury if they're defending a free kick or something. I'm like, well, you need to. I keep them off for longer because, quite frankly, you know, it's just you can't trust players not to cheat and waste time by doing that. So you have to disadvantage them. And real injury, then so be it. But
well, that's why they call it gamesmanship now. They've got a way to gamesmanship. It's a way of sort of excusing it, isn't it?
Yeah, calling it gamesmanship or he's being clever there. No, he's not. He's cheating. Like, they're just, some of them are scummy. Anyway, let's not go on to that. But yeah, so the Jags won, and the Oilers started their pre-season with 2 wins and a loss. So, yeah, we're doing all right.
Yeah, the Birkin sports stable is not at its lowest ebb. That's nice.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Do you want a story of the week?
Yeah. I mean, my story of the week was going to be that I'm not going to watch Sheffield Wednesday against QPR, but instead going to play golf for the first time in a year and watch the Ryder Cup, where I really hope we stuff those money-grabbing Americans who are deciding. That should be the story of the week. We want to get paid to star in the Ryder Cup. Like, no, the Europeans aren't getting paid. Like, it's just, and they're charging $750 a ticket to go and watch it. It's just, I mean, the players are going, so the players' argument is, yeah, but the Ryder Cup makes all this money because they're charging so much, you know, we should get some of it. Like, no. Your story of the week.
Yes, yeah, so we're about 4 or 5 minutes in and you've insulted all footballers and American golfers. It's a good start.
I think that's
So I've actually got two for you. So the first one, a new freelance writer, a guy called Martin Bjork, he's come on board and he's started with a piece digging into, you know, the motivations behind tax increases in Europe. So that's obviously something that we've talked about quite a lot on the podcast. It's interesting to get a few different industry perspectives on that. So definitely recommend reading that. And second, just because I think the news is very interesting, I wanted to bring up Yolo Group. Okay. So Yolo Group, a big crypto operator, you know, incredible business, really kind of meteoric rise. They are pivoting from grey markets to a regulated offering, issuing licenses in the UAE. I think they also mentioned Finland. There's another one where they expect to grow. And as part of this, they are shutting down sportsbet.io and bitcasino.io, which were their two, you know, kind of like global operations. So they are shutting that down for this full regulated market pivot. And I mean, it's one of these things. I remember I saw you know, the announcement, and you kind of start skimming it, and then you suddenly think, holy shit, this is actually a huge deal. Like, that is a real kind of line in the sand for a crypto operator to draw.
Well, it's also quite strange thing to do, because I don't know why they wouldn't just do what, how do we put this out, being sued, others allegedly would do, where you just hive them off into a arm's length other entity, mm-hmm. and then just keep making loads of money, and then just have your own, you know, go, oh, it's nothing to do with those, it just, you know. If you go through 17 different shell companies, you may find the same beneficial owner. So actually just shutting it down, yeah, I mean, they make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, they make, both those brands are incredibly successful. But it's interesting as well, the fact they're going into the UAE, because GCGRA has been very vocal about the fact that it wants to create this kind of, you know, innovation hub within the regulated environment. So they want to look at kind of new products and new whether it's mechanics, whether it's kind of forms of delivery, and find a way to do that responsibly and safely, but also sustainably in a regulated environment. And someone like Yolo Group, obviously with the capabilities that it has, because don't forget, on top of these B2C operations, it's got a B2B operation, and then it's got Yolo Ventures, where it's been putting money into a lot of companies. It was like one of the businesses, I remember, I went to their kind of investor showcase in Tallinn a few years ago, because essentially they were building out a bank. You know, it's really kind of big, ambitious project. So it's the fact that it is essentially kind of pivoting in this way is really quite remarkable. And also, I think it shows a lot of leadership. I think that's one of the things that really impresses me about it. Well, I think of having built up a business in a largely grey environment, to then disavow that.
Oh, I couldn't. Well, I'm not saying I couldn't disagree more, but I think that is just being so nice. I haven't read the article you guys have written. I'm sure it's all lovey-dovey.
I don't think that is naive, and I will tell you why.
I will do a counter-argument. I'm not saying this is my view, but let's do a counter-argument.
Okay.
You have companies that for a long time have been mainly operating in regulated environments. Mm-hmm. These guys have been operating, quote unquote, illegally to make a shit ton of money that now puts them in a very beneficial situation to compete with people in regulated environments, because they've got a load of money they made illegally, whatever you want to call it, to not be sued. So if you're in, let's say, I don't know, Denmark, Sweden, like something where your profit margins have been hammered and you're making very little money. And in the past 3 or 4 years, all these grey market, I'm going to call them operators, have been crypto things, have just taken huge amounts of money out of the market without any tax, because that's why we've seen the channelization go down with the rise of these. They suddenly go, oh, we'll get a license. We've got a customer base. We've just made a load of money. And now I've got a war chest to compete against you guys who don't have that same war chest, because you haven't been making much money because you've been operating legally. That's not leadership. That's cheating, effectively. That's one argument. I get
literally how every phase of the industry develops. You think about online coming up. Online was essentially grey, if not black, and then the companies pivoted to regulated markets.
Yeah, when they it was grey, and then when they regulate. So if you, let's say you're doing some purer one, you know, they operate from Malta, Gibraltar, wherever, and then let's say now Finland regulates, so then they go, okay, we'll get a Finnish market, or France regulates, we'll get a French license and do that. Yeah. That's very different to continuing to operate in a market that has a set, this is Denmark. This is, the only legal gambling is with a Danish license. I don't care if you're based in Curaçao, Gibraltar, or whatever. If you continue to operate in that market without a license, then I think you're getting an unfair advantage against the licensed people and use the money you've made to then fight against them. I don't think that, not yellow, but I think that there's an argument that as much as regulators want to get as many people on shore as possible to try and have the onshore channelization, you know, whether they, if you've been blatantly disregarding the rules, whether you should be allowed to get licensed.
Well, there's obviously going to be suitability tests, but this is literally what happens. Land-based operators said this about the online operators back in the day. The new entrants into US sports betting said this about legacy DFS operators. This is how
they didn't do anything wrong with DFS. Well, I suppose it goes back into sweepstakes. That's the whole thing we've covered before.
I suppose
the flip argument is, like, let's say something in Peru or Chile, you know, is it like Chile will argue that it is black and white illegal now because there's no licensing framework, but it just should be polished Chilena. So I know you can get down, but I'm saying there is an argument. I'm not saying I'm going down that one, but as a counter argument to you saying it's leadership and admirable, I'm like, you could argue it's actually the complete opposite way around. It's just cheating. So it's probably somewhere in the middle, but I wouldn't say, fair play to them, they're turning off a lot of free money, quite frankly. But, you know, should they have got that in the first place? You know, you could say people who have been admirable and did that 10 years ago, they're like, well, hang on, you're praising them because they just decided to do it later.
No, I think in the current context, one of what I've definitely been seeing recently, and a lot of other people have commented on this as well, is the grey/black operators are becoming a lot more visible and almost, let's face it, you know, gleeful at how clever they've been to find these new ways to make all this money. And essentially, it's the old industry cycle going again. These companies will rise up, there'll be a regulatory crackdown, they will have to pivot. YOLO hasn't waited for that inflection point where there's a crackdown. It's moved ahead of that. So two things out of that. First of all, you could say it's altruistic. Second of all, you could say it's farsighted. I'd say it's probably more farsighted, which suggests there's some either indication or awareness that these crackdowns will happen. If you think about the poker sites in the US, there was what, I won't name them. I don't know why I won't name them, but whatever. One of them, you felt that when the indictments were unsealed, it was a case of saying, well, we knew this day would come. What do we need to do to make this right? Whereas the other one just went into chaos and collapsed.
I mean, everyone knows that PokerStars are the first one and Full Tilt's the second.
Yeah.
PokerStars just then effectively bought Full Tilt just to appease the DOJ. And so people got their money back and just got them to sign off. Well, look, there's someone at Party Gaming a long time ago. He's no longer there. So I could say this, nothing to do with the current management or their view. One person's view that was probably widely held, who said their biggest mistake was leaving the US in 2006 because they could just carried on and made all the money. And suddenly they just became this pretty small fish from having been a market leader because they adhered to the regulations. Now, you could argue in the US it's different because poker's never been proven to be illegal and they actually just got done through miscoding of transactions and blah, blah, blah. However, I mean, it just goes to show, as much as we're both proponents of onshore market and channelization, etc., more money is to be made by being an illegal operator. And if you were setting up a website now, why would you get licensed in many places?
Yeah,
that's not an IGB thing, it's not an H2 thing. Like,
no, that is just looking at the state of the market and the conditions under which the licensees are expected to regulate.
I mean, Stake, they announced last year 4.7 billion. Mm-hmm. I mean, how much of that was regulated? No, they're now starting to get regulated, etc. But it's, you know, it's a lot easier to start, you know, if you're a startup trying to raise some money and go into a regulated market, it's tough.
Yeah.
If you're already making $4.7 billion of GGR, you know, that's the number they announced themselves. Of course, they've got an advantage.
Yeah.
And they've got an advantage because they're getting it from markets that they're not regulated in. But you know what? We'll call it. We will go, well done, you guys. This is so altruistic of you and you are showing great leadership in the industry. You know, well done.
Such cynicism.
Right. I have a call in 20 minutes because you were late because you had a call. Why don't we skip on to the ones that we're doing and talking about B2C, B2B operators? Why don't we go with Golden Matrix first rather than Singapore?
I want to talk about Singapore first.
Well, you're in charge, so let's talk about Singapore.
Yeah, let's talk about Singapore, because especially the land-based market, because I think that's a really interesting point of discussion, because essentially it's a tale of two properties. You've got Marina Bay Sands operated by a Las Vegas Sands, and you have Resorts World Sentosa operated by Genting Singapore, a subsidiary of Genting Group. One of them is performing very well, has hit 500 million visitors since opening, and has had its license extended for the full length of the term. The other one is struggling, quite frankly. For the first time ever, a property didn't get the full three-year license. It was only given two because of weak performance in the wake of COVID. So I think it was, I can't remember the exact wording, but I think in the CRA, the Casino Regulatory Authority's assessment, it was in need of great improvement. Both are investing. There's development work going on at Marina Bay Sands. Resorts World Sentosa is building a theme park. It's going to have something called Minion World. Minions.
You look a bit like a minion.
I don't look like a minion. What the fuck?
Yes, you do.
How do I look like a minion?
If a minion had a beard and glasses. It's like the little shiny head. Yeah, you're like a little minion. Yeah. I mean, that's maybe doing a disservice to minions, but yeah.
Well, I think it's doing a disservice to me.
Oh, I can see you look like a minion. I'll find some names of the minions for the next episode.
Okay.
But yeah. Okay, let's put this into context then, the size of market. So yeah, so Singapore, you've got a bit of betting monopoly with Singapore Pools, who also have the lottery, and then you've got gaming. So you've got these two integrated resorts, and then you have some slots in gaming clubs.
Yeah.
More locals. So gaming market, so for two integrated resorts, was 5.7 billion Singapore dollars, 4 billion US dollars in 2024, which was up 24% on the pre-COVID level. Yeah, that is impressive growth. And this year, we're expected to get up to 6.4 billion, so just under $5 billion. So you've got two properties making $5 billion US dollars of gaming revenue between them. I mean, that's not shabby. But as you said, if you look at in 2024, Genting accounted for 30% of gaming revenues, but it was 36% in 2019. Wow. So this 24% market growth, that's been driven purely by Sands. So Sands is up 34% to 4 billion Singapore dollars. And over the same period, Genting's up 5% to 1.7 billion. So it really has just been completely one-sided in terms of what's happened since COVID, hence what you're talking about with the licensing. But they are both, you say, they're both expanding. So Genting has five hotels, over 1,600 rooms, and got provisional permission to build another 700 on top of that. Like, yeah. That is huge growth they're putting in.
Oh, it's fast. They're also building an aquarium. I think they've got a water park and Minion World. And I'm still amazed that you know what minions are.
Yeah, they're the little funny, you know, yellow things. One of them's got glasses. Or they're like goggles, don't they?
I'm thinking of munchkins.
I'm sure I could find a minion that looks just like you. Like, do you see? You don't even know what a minion is.
No, I was thinking of munchkins. I was thinking of the you know, like the Lollipop Guild in The Wizard of Oz.
What? I don't really know what a munchkin is. Who's munchkins? They are from Wizard of Oz. Yeah. To be honest, you don't look too dissimilar to a munchkin either.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
This feels like karmic retribution for all the times I said you look like Donnie Wahlberg, isn't it?
I'd take Donnie Wahlberg all day long, quite frankly. In fact, I'm into, you know, season 9 of Blue Bloods at the moment. Anyway, we're going off track. So
yes,
you're like a munchkin and a minion. Las Vegas Sands are smashing it in Singapore. It's still a huge market. Resorts World's not doing as well, but are massively expanding all of their non-gaming offering, which should, you'd assume, help with the gaming revenue. So we're forecasting the market to continue to grow well.
Okay. And then what about the Singapore Pools? Because that's essentially a de facto sports betting monopoly. Is that fair to say? Or betting?
Betting, yeah. So yeah, betting. Their lottery is 2.7 billion Singapore dollars. Mm-hmm. So whatever that is, a bit, so 2 billion US dollars. So decent size. And their monopoly on betting is about 460 million Singapore dollars. And that's predominantly football. Now, what happened last year? They ceased horse racing operations in Singapore. Yeah. So the final race was held on the 5th of October. And they're redeveloping that because the land value is just worth a lot more than that. Now, It's my understanding they are continuing to offer horse race betting. It's not the track in Singapore. So the scale of that will diminish. So next year we have football at over 80% of the market. And there's a very little bit on motorsports, so probably F1, because they have the F1 Grand Prix. But it's pretty much, as you say, a football betting market. Now, I know they're looking, well, I don't know they're looking at, but I assume, because I know that other monopolies in that area are looking at trying to expand the sports, so it's like a couple of extra, like basketball and things like that, whether that would help. But at the end of the day, there is just going to be a huge illegal offering that is very difficult to compete against. What? But maybe the owners of some of these businesses will show market leadership and be very altruistic and decide to come on shore at some point and close down their illegal offering, and we should tell them how amazing they are.
I'm not telling them how amazing they are. I'm just saying I think it does show some leadership. But you mentioned a big illegal market there. I mean, what's the onshore-offshore split for Singapore?
It's difficult. If we look at kind of the visible kind of grey bit, you know, it's well over kind of two-thirds as being offshore. However, problem is, and I'm still unsure exactly how to do this analysis to be a really kind of data-driven thing you can track on. A lot of it is, again, just done with cash transaction, so you may be doing the actual betting online, but it's all kind of cash.
A bit like an agent.
Book is. And so when you're looking at web traffic, if it's all of that, yeah, you can capture some of it, but not anywhere near what the true black illegal market is. So, you know, kind of take a guess, really. So that's the issue with our legal market Asian numbers is you can track the likes of us. Not saying they would be there, but the sportsbet.io or someone like that, or, you know, some of the crypto ones, you know, what they're doing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you can't, the big activity with agents and stuff like that is so hard to do.
Golden Matrix.
So.
Yes. So you've got it down. Them. Yeah, well, you've got it down as a supplier. Last year they acquired MeridianBet. So that's a $300 million deal. That takes them into B2C operations, so you need to update your systems to reflect this. Do you have a category for hybrid businesses?
We don't, and so we're just going to decide which is their main part of their business. And to be honest, since they acquired MeridianBet, I will acknowledge that now that 90% of their revenues comes from B2C, they probably should be moved across to the operator category.
Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying we're going to do that. I'm just saying they should do.
Okay. Oh, that's good. It's just, it's good you acknowledge it, but as long as there isn't, no follow-ups on that.
MeridianBet. It's nice that people are honest, I think, you know.
So MeridianBet is an interesting one because it's one of these businesses, like talking to some of their management last year, you don't really realise the scale of it. Like it's active in Peru, it's active in Eastern Europe, it's active in Africa. But what is interesting about that is it's another Eastern European business that started out in, you know, brick and mortar, kind of retail betting, kiosk shops, and is now expanding online. Maybe not to the same scale as a Superbet or someone like that, but it is more evidence of these companies using their in-person platform or foundation to build an online business.
That and just developing a good scalable business in a market where some of the traditional guys just weren't that interested. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, when I was back in the city and look at, you know, the Sporting Bets and Ladbrokes at the time, Antein and, you know, blah, 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 William Hill, 888, and none of them were talking about launching in Serbia.
No.
There's a market, it's a decent market, you then become market leadership and expand. And as you say, you know, they're making, you know, good amounts of revenue. So to put it into context, when they got bought at the beginning of Q2 24, their revenue went from Golden Matrix's revenue went from $10 million in Q2 23 to $40 million in Q2 24, and it's like $11 million in Q1. So effectively $30 million a quarter. So $120 million plus of revenue is now coming from, you know, MeridianBet. So it's a good business. To say they got licensed last year in South Africa. They've got one this year in Nigeria.
I think they're also licensed in Peru.
Yeah, so they look at LATAM. What's interesting is they didn't, before the deal, they used to disclose a split of revenues. Prior to the acquisition, Golden Matrix was 39% Asia, 59% UK, and 2% from LATAM. Mm-hmm. Even with the presentation of the acquisition, there is zero geographical analysis done. So, yeah, we think a lot of it is in in these markets, and they've got license, it's like 15 licenses. Yeah, they've got a decent amount of licenses.
Mm-hmm.
It does make me a little skeptical when they don't give any of their
of course
geographical distribution. So that, yeah, Meridianbet is the, I say they're looking to scale. Mm-hmm. Say LATAM and Africa, I think, are things that they're looking at, and they've got the Eastern Europe as their traditional powerhouse. So, I mean, we've talked about before, if you look at the likes of Superbet and stuff, you know, there are a number of these Eastern European businesses that come from very small, gone online, and, you know, are in a strong position to kind of take on the traditional bigger operators.
Yeah, as I said
isn't
earlier.
It interesting one that Golden
what?
Matrix bought it. Well, yeah, I wouldn't have had Golden Matrix down as a natural buyer, to be honest.
No, but these combinations occasionally work. I'm not saying it's not going to. I think it is interesting, the nature of that business, because obviously that Golden Matrix business, I think it was a platform. I think they had maybe an aggregator. There's some sort of like prize draw stuff, which you always worry toes the line with, you know, the sweepstakes products we're seeing. I'm always a bit wary of those in terms of, you know, how we kind of present them, you know, in our coverage and indeed in this podcast. But maybe that's part of the reason behind this. I mean, like, just the example that jumps to mind here is someone like Amaya. They bought a load of, I think the good way to put this was, be past their peak supply side businesses. So I'm thinking like Cryptologic, people like that. They acquired these businesses, they built up operations revenue, and then they used that to make a pivot. In their case, it was obviously acquiring PokerStars. So it could be a similar approach. Yeah.
Right. Let's look at what we're doing next week, because.
Yes. Well, no, we are doing nothing next week.
Okay.
Because we will hold next week's episode so we can turn 20.
Okay. In that case, are we going to do something for G2E? As in, are we going to do a country and a thing, or are we just going to ad lib? Let's ad lib.
Let's talk about Nevada. We'll talk about the Nevada market.
Okay. All right.
Let's do that.
Done.
Nice and easy. Okay. Well, on that note, we will let you go. It has been an absolute pleasure, as ever, to speak to Miss Red Birkin. I'm not sure where I'm going with this outro, but I'm just going to persevere. This has been episode 20. Right to the Source. No episode next week because we'll hold off for Vegas and
our coming of age.
What a terrifying thought. Come a long way from a studio in Brazil. Well, I think we peaked in our first episode, and then
I was going to say, looking at my office and your dining room, I think that the studio in Brazil was probably the peak, episode one. And then 21 will be on the show floor at G2E.
Yes, we will. All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you in the next one.